This is The Conversation. It's a podcast that goes behind the scenes and between the lines of the contemporary art worlds. Welcome to the show. I am Michael Shaw. This is episode 286 with Miriam Basilio. She is a professor of art history and museum studies at NYU and a former curator at the Museum of Modern Art, which we talk quite a bit about. The website for this show is theconversationpod.com, where you can, on the episode page for this here episode, see images of Miriam out and about, probably abroad, and among other things, her drawing of Princess Grace of Monaco, which she mailed to Princess Grace of Monaco. Don't think she got a response, but she tried. How are you guys doing? Got a few things that I want to catch up on before I give you a little bit more information about this episode. Hope you guys are doing okay. It's the second episode of 2021, a time where you are either wavering towards great optimism or you are wavering towards great caution and maybe even a little bit of concern or even fear, and where there are a lot of Bernie memes going around. And I was going to say, please, no more Bernie in a chair with his mask on memes. But Van, who is doing a lot of the Instagram, reposted in our stories a pic of Bernie on his chair with a big bunch of balloons about to lift him in the sky. So maybe that's a little bit of an interesting twist, but no, it's just, it reached peak capacity within 24 hours. It's not funny anymore, if it ever was. So can we please stop the Bernie memes? Thank you so much to those of you who support the show, big time supporters on Patreon who continue to support the show month by month. Thank you to you guys. And if you guys like this show, by the way, I do have a couple of music recommendations coming up and an update on the Virtual Cafe, among other things. But I do want to quickly just say that if you guys like this show and you want to support it, even for whether it's a dollar a month on Patreon or a one-time donation of, say, $20 or ideally more, if you go up to 30, I will definitely make you all in on the bonus episodes, including possibly the latest Virtual Cafe that we did with Robin Kaiser Schatzlein, which I'll talk more about in a second. You can support the show by going to theconversationpod.com/support, and you can support us a number of ways, whether Patreon, PayPal, Venmo, old-fashioned check, or if you are really in a position where you cannot afford to support the show. And by the way, if you're getting a lot of value from this, if you're a grad student, undergrad student, you're a teacher and you're referring people to the show, you know, hey, maybe chip in a few bucks would be awesome. Then you can support the show by leaving a nice review on Apple Podcasts so other people can find the show. You can offer recommendations for the show. You can offer to help the show, something that we could use, actually, and so on. So, and you could spread the word. That's always appreciated. Thank you very much in advance. I also want to thank, really quickly, those who help on the show, everyone from Van Cascinero, who is our social media guru, to those who make this show happen production-wise, Lydia Kegler, Angela Groom, and I want to offer a big welcome to new producer Allison Widows, who has been awesome right out of the gate. And I hereby agree and commit to the next $200 that comes in supporting the show over the next month, I will give the first $200 to these supporters. And probably Adam Vail, who had to step down from his support due to being too busy with work. I will definitely want to contribute some of that to him. So just FYI, if that changes your perception of supporting the show. Okay, so we had a virtual cafe with special guest Robin Kaiser Schatzlein, who wrote an article in the New Republic about the history of the creative class in this country and about creative workers unionizing, which is something he is involved in himself as a museum worker. And we had a really good, solid Q&A for about an hour, actually, if you include my questions at the beginning. This hopefully will be turned into an episode, still in the wait and see phase, but if not, hopefully you can turn it into a bonus episode that you supporters of the show will have access to. So, but if, in any case, if you are interested in proposing people for the virtual cafe and or you would like to come to the next virtual cafe and you're not already on that email list, reach out to us, theconversationhourpodcast@gmail.com, and we will get you on that list or and or accept your proposal for a special guest presenter, that is. And we basically, you know, have the person present for anywhere from a couple of minutes to 10 or 15 minutes and then break out into a Q&A. And then if there's time, we split up into breakout rooms where we might discuss what we're discussing, or we will just, people will just kind of chat, catch up. It's mainly regulars at this point, but we would love to have new people into that fold at any time. So you're all welcome. So you heard me mention last episode that I became enamored of this band Pylon's debut album from 1980 called Gyrate, which I still love. I subsequently got their second album from 1983 called Chomp and have been pretty disappointed, definitely disappointed. I say pretty because I've continued to listen and there are a few really good songs, but overall, definitely a big disappointment. The reason I'm bringing this up again is because I mentioned that I would love to have heard them live based on what I've been hearing from that great first album. I was listening to the No More Heroes radio show out of KXLU, the station out of Loyola Marymount here in Los Angeles, college radio station, and on a whim, I called up Tony, the host of the show, and said, "Hey, are you a fan of Pylon?" And he said, "Yeah, I like them." And when I asked him more questions, he kind of admitted that he wasn't that familiar with their work. But Dave, who runs the record store, the basement of which Tony is using for his radio show lately, along with a couple of other DJs, he's a big Pylon fan. So I said, "Oh, well, can I talk to Dave?" And he put me on with Dave. And Dave and I had a nice chat in which Dave said Pylon is the best live band he has ever seen. So that was some serious confirmation. He went on to talk about why they were so great. But in any case, if you guys are at all curious, I know you come here for my music recommendations. 2, 3, 4. But if you want an entry for Pylon, just look up Functionality, Pylon, P-Y-L-O-N. You can get it on Spotify. Unbelievable. In fact, tear-inducing, even. I also wanted to add that I have been getting really into the Slits album from 1979 called Cut, and I mentioned this not only as a recommendation, but for the fact that initially I was really down on it. It was like, oh man, this is shit. But except for, of course, Typical Girls, which is their classic, and their cover of Heard It Through the Grapevine, which is one of the greatest covers ever. But with multiple listens later, I am like, yeah, I am down. This is awesome. All right, so that's my music recommendations. Now, maybe I should finally talk about this here episode. So Miriam talks about diversity in museum curating, being that she is basically the first curator of Puerto Rican descent to work, or from Puerto Rico, to work at MoMA, among other groundbreaking aspects of her career. She also talks about her love of fashion and spending a lot of time in Spain and what the art community and whatnot is like there, among other things. So I hope you guys enjoy. Oh, one other thing before we get into the episode. I have been having some audio challenges lately. You know, was on autopilot for the longest time, and then maybe within the last year, you know, some issues have crept up that are maybe related to the Google Voice platform I'm using, maybe related to the software Audacity that I'm using, maybe a little bit of both. In any case, if any of you happen to have a certain amount of audio tech expertise and would like to donate, you know, 15 to 20, 30 minutes tops of your time to help troubleshoot with me, I would very much appreciate it. And non-audio tech people, if you're interested in contributing to the show, I can definitely find a role for you. So reach out, theconversationartpodcast@gmail.com. Enough spieling. Let's get to the episode. I hope you guys are staying safe. I actually had to get tested again for the second time because my studio mate tested positive. We hadn't had really any close contact, but, you know, needed to be safe, negative, thankfully. So hope you guys are been staying negative. If any of you did by any chance test positive, would love to hear about it, how you're quarantining, how your experience with COVID was or is. All right. Thank you for bearing with me. Let's get to the episode. Hope you guys are doing well, and I'll talk to you in a couple weeks. Be well. You're a professor of art history. You were a curator. What are some of the main differences for you between academia and the sort of more private curatorial world?
Well, in curating, I was privileged at the museum because I was, even though I had a very junior position, I was able to actually co-curate two exhibitions. So that was really exciting. And there were some cases, they were commissions. So I got to work closely with artists in the creating of a work of art. I also enjoyed, you know, going in the storage and being able to observe the objects firsthand. And but then being an academic, I love doing research, and I can still do that kind of work and do artist visits and, you know, write and teach. So I don't know. It's hard to decide which one I like more, but I guess I've been a professor for 15 years. So that's probably what I enjoy the most.
Can you say what museum that was that you're referring to? Was that MoMA?
Oh, sure. Well, I had, when I was in graduate school, I had worked in smaller institutions like El Museo del Barrio. But my, you know, sort of major museum job was at the Museum of Modern Art, where I was hired in 2001. Mm-hmm. And then I left in 2005 to join New York University as an art history and museum studies professor.
What are some of the pros and cons, or, you know, other sort of comparisons between being, you know, working for a museum versus working in academia? I mean, I imagine there's a little more glamour in museum curating, but maybe not as much job security. Is that a correct estimation or not necessarily?
Yeah, I mean, for me, working at MoMA was a dream, as I assume it would be for many people. And actually, I was the first Puerto Rican person to hold a curatorial position at that museum. There, you know, now there's a little bit more diversity in the ranks, but it was, you know, it was not easy to get a job like that. And it was just an absolute thrill. And there were glamorous things where, you know, you were kind of off on the sidelines watching the 1%, you know, kind of entertaining themselves.
Wait. And, let me stop you there. Can you please elaborate on what you mean by that?
Oh, sure. I enjoyed it because sometimes we had people from the acquisitions committee that would give us tickets, for example, to the opening of the Armory show. And I'm a big fashion person, so I would really enjoy, you know, looking at what all the millionaires and billionaires were wearing. And, you know, like the member of the acquisition committee that invited us was wearing, you know, all white, including a white fur coat. And I was just mesmerized, you know, by the Hermes bags and just all of that stuff. And I was someone that was very good at doing vintage shopping and thrift shopping. So people always would compliment me, and I would just get a kick out of telling all these rich curatorial assistant colleagues, you know, these young women who were very rich. I would, you know, I would say, oh, this is vintage. You know, this is, and they would just, their jaws would drop.
Right. That's another sort of noteworthy point about the structure of the art world, not only the diversity that you were talking about, or lack thereof, I should say, but that stereotype, which holds up, particularly at least the way you're describing it, where the workers, the lower people down, I guess, in museums, in the curatorial space, but perhaps in analogous jobs in, you know, in galleries and so on, are often people who come from means. And that's kind of the sort of image that you were alluding to. Was that your experience?
Yeah, and then they have, you know, I tell my students this because I teach a class called Museums and the Art Market, and mm-hmm. I break down, you know, the class politics too.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, some of these folks come in and they have cultural capital and social capital because their families are rich. So they know who collects what, you know, or they can fit in very easily at an auction house because they have all that insider information and they're familiar with all of those people and those families. Mm. And that was stuff that I didn't understand what they were talking about.
Right. Yeah.
I wasn't trained for that.
Yeah. I think that's a great example. The auction world seems to me just, you know, intuitively to be more composed of, you know, people with, as you say, cultural capital are coming from places where they can wield their family / wealth influence the best.
And the fact is, you know, the salaries were horrible. I mean, so many people in various departments of that museum, but I know it happens at other museums. I'm not singling out MoMA specifically, you know, just as the only one, would have other jobs. Like they would take on extra, you know, consulting or whatever, part-time, something or other, even though our jobs required almost 7 day a week work in order to keep up with what they were asking us to do.
Mm.
So the amount of money for somebody with a doctorate, like I was asked by a trustee about my salary because, well, it had to do with a project that I was working on that had to do with what she does. And she asked me and I said, look, I just investigated this and my salary is the same as that of a manager at a Burger King.
Mm.
In New York City. I was, no disrespect, okay? Like, you know, my dad was a gardener at one point. I'm not trying to, like, you know, disrespect. I'm just saying I had 2 master's degrees and a doctorate, and I was getting paid a salary that was equivalent to that other job.
Yeah. Well, what was the context? Can you flesh out a little bit more? Was it okay that this trustee was asking you about your salary? What was the detail there?
Well, because... I was working on some programs that interested the trustee, and sometimes trustees support the salaries of people on the staff as part of the, for example, if you see there's a lot of curatorial positions, and I've been trying to find out when this began, that have the name of a collector or a patron of the museum attached.
Right.
So, for example, you know, the Estrellita Brodsky, curator of X at the
right.
Metropolitan Museum of Art. Do you
yeah,
know what
yeah.
I mean?
Yeah.
No, I was never that high up. But it was more just that she would give some money and then that money could partially go to my salary. I used to joke about it though, and I used to say that that I should be promoted to assistant curator and that I should have one of those titles attached, and it would be the J-Lo. The J-Lo assistant curator for Latin American art. And that used to make people laugh.
So
I haven't had access to J-Lo to ask her
right.
to see if she would endow a position like that.
Yeah, yeah. So did that trustee then, was that trustee supplementing your salary?
You know, I never knew. That was some person even get concerned. You know, why do they even bother with like somebody at my level? You
right.
know?
But wouldn't you know if your salary changed, or would it be possible that they were supplementing your salary, but it was still the same lower level that it was?
No, I mean, there's I sometimes museums have staff that are brought in thanks to money from a grant to organize a particular exhibition,
mm-hmm.
or there's some kind of a foundation that comes in to allow for, you know, a curatorial research fellow or something like that.
Right.
And so they're kind of like temporary jobs. And that I was under the sort of person working on an exhibition category versus this is a permanent person that could eventually be promoted.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so, and that was because of at the time, you know, the program to work on Latin American art was kind of getting off the ground, and it wasn't conceived of as something that was like going to be structurally part of it. It was just outside curators that were being brought in who were seeing program collecting But now there's like, you know, two curators in the museum, senior, who specialize in Latin American art, which is phenomenal. And mm-hmm. they have other staff that are working with them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really wonderful. And I know them both and they're great.
Mm-hmm. Is that something that part of you would have wanted to stick around somehow until you could become a senior curator in that department?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I would have loved to have stayed and it just took a long time for things to kind of coalesce the way they have now. And it's incredible. I mean, they have all this research that they've been doing. They've bought a lot of work.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, temporary shows. I mean, you can see it when they reopen the museum. You can see how many of the works included were by artists from the Americas besides the United States. So there were things that I just never dreamed would happen when I left the museum.
Yeah. Do you mind talking about that moment that you shared with me earlier where you, you know, saw the works, and I can't remember what exhibition it was, but that, you know, the moment that particularly moved you because the representation that you were seeing?
Oh, yeah. So when I was in the museum, one of the projects we did was an exhibition with El Museo del Barrio. A group of curators from both institutions looked at the history of the collection of works by Latin American artists and Caribbean artists. And we displayed it at El Museo because MoMA was under construction.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was really interesting to go back and see a lot of works that hadn't been exhibited in many decades and just, you know, do some updating of the research. And then right after that, the museum reopened in its new, you know, the Taniguchi building and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And it was all top secret. Nobody could know. It was only like the three people in the Department of Painting and Sculpture that were doing the layout that were aware, you know, no one could see anything. So it was a surprise to us. And when I went, I was in the kind of like the patrons opening, and there was nobody, almost nobody there. And I was walking around and I started noticing all of these works, like a painting, you know, a painting by Diego Rivera in a gallery with Cubist art, you know, very close by to Picasso's, Demoiselle, and like, et cetera. And I literally started to cry because I never thought that these works would be shown, you know, alongside their peers. And it was, yeah, it was really incredible. It was really because we had worked so hard, and just to see that some of these artists were being given their due was a big deal.
Did you share that moment with anybody, or was it a private moment?
Yeah, I shared it with John Elderfield, who was the chief curator of painting and sculpture. And then he retired, and he was working. He's still, I think, working with Gagosian and other institutions. And John was the head person on this project. And so he saw me and I said, oh, John, I said, thank you so much. This is so, you know, this is so great that there's so many Latin American artists, you know, this is making me tear up. I don't even know why I did this. Like, I think I was so overwhelmed that I didn't think about what I was saying. And John has this like English accent, and he's very dry sense of humor. And he was just like, yes, I had thought about putting Kleenexes in the galleries.
Right.
He was really funny. And he was, you know, someone that was very interested in a lot of the artists from Latin America. So
mm-hmm,
that's mm-hmm, partly mm-hmm. why this happened.
Yeah. Did you feel as a curator there, you know, prior to this sort of breakthrough moment, at least for, you know, in that emotional way, did you feel along the way kind of like an outsider or not part of the, you know, not part of the inner circle or, you know, what have you?
I mean, for me, it was strange because, yeah, I felt like an outsider because, well, there was a point where there was an African-American scholar and curator, Sarah Lewis, who was working at MoMA, and we overlapped. So, you know, she's African-American. But, you know, there weren't really other people there were Asian people in curatorial. So in that sense, I felt kind of cut off. And then, like, as I said to you, the fact that, you know, some of these people were just evidently very, very wealthy.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's not like I was poor, you know, it's like, I would say middle class, but, you know, that was, kind of weird. And then also my position was odd because I was being asked to co-curate these two exhibitions, but I was still a curatorial assistant. So I basically had two jobs because I was doing the curatorial work, but then I was also my own kind of secretary. Do you know what I mean? It was a little bit odd. And so other departments in the museum didn't exactly recognize my role as the curator, the authority that I had in that arena.
Right.
And were asking me to do other things. And so that was very stressful.
Mm-hmm. Were there equivalent curators or curatorial assistants in other departments who did have more resources, you know, maybe had an assistant or, you know, or there were enough people where it could be split in such a way that the assistant curator wasn't doing, you know, administrative type stuff the way you were?
I mean, I think it's just a, it's just an unusual situation because some, a curatorial assistant usually wouldn't be curating a show. It would just be, you know, I think now it's changed a lot in many museums because I notice it, for example, New Museum or the Whitney, where they have the name of the person and then it'll say assisted by, and they'll give credit to the assistant or curatorial assistant. And that's really exciting. But there were some old school MoMA people when I got there that felt that even the big curator, you know, the high rank curator shouldn't have a name there. It's the institution that's has the authorship.
Mm-hmm. And what was the, what was the flagship or the big show that you were worked on curating? Or maybe there were more than one.
Oh, well, interestingly, they were both off-site. So one of them was called Tempo, and it was at MoMA Q&S when it opened. And then the MoMA del Museo show was, at, as the title indicates, was held at Museo del Barrio.
The reason I ask, I'm just trying to get a sense of to what extent you were visiting artist studios as opposed to maybe, you know, estates or what have you.
Well, for Tempo, we did visit artist studios, and I think I mentioned we had commissioned pieces. So that was very exciting. And so each each of the curators divided, we divided up the commissions and then, you know, worked with the artists to facilitate that and with the rest of our colleagues in other departments that were, you know, had to do with, I don't know, audiovisual or whatever.
Right.
And that was really amazing. And then I just, I did a, some research, but just on my own, you know, with artists, but being in the museum, I couldn't write about it. Like I was asked by a Spanish magazine to write about a survey of contemporary drawing, but then I had to run it by the head of the department. And then it was considered that that was not a good idea because it would sound like somebody in curatorial was kind of endorsing certain artists that MoMA would acquire. So I ended up not writing that article. I wrote something about a specific article at another magazine later on.
Has it been noticeably different visiting artists as a professor versus when you were a curator?
Definitely, because, you know, I don't have the name of MoMA behind me, which creates a lot of expectations. I mean, I remember also when I decided to go to NYU, there were certain people that were not really interested in talking to me, which is fine. You know, people are networking professionally, and that's what they're doing. But I like it because now it's more relaxed and I can develop like these long-term relationships with artists, and I've become friends with some of them. And, you know, I do have plans to organize exhibitions, and I've been trying to pitch them, but it's not very easy. But I do have some ideas already. And like I said, I've been doing artist visits. And in the meantime, I'll write articles. And then I'll have the article. And hopefully I'll find a venue.
So in other words, if I might sort of venture why those denials of studio visits, are we talking about artists who are approached by you and because there's no real throughway to an institution, you know, museum ideally specifically, it's a waste of their time? Is that, do you think that's where they're coming from?
No, I never got to that point. I just mean like people that you know in general, like sort of on a professional, like sort of to say hi to at an opening. There wasn't like this urgency to continue talking.
Oh, wow. That's so in other words,
I was never, it was never like about an artist or anything like that.
Every
I've only had one artist, and that was recently, be, you know, kind of I don't know how to explain it, but be very sort of dismissive, I guess, of me seeking information about their work and hopefully, you know, to see if I could talk to them via Zoom or whatever. But everybody else is super generous with their time. And I'm always really upfront with them. I'm like, look, I don't know if I'm going to be able to find a venue. I'm probably just going to write an article for right now, but I'd love to know more about your work. And then it just goes on from there.
So then for the people that, as you said, you know, you would say hi to at events, openings and so on, in the museum world, because you are no longer with MoMA, but you are with a university, in their eyes, your cultural capital had devalued.
Yeah. I mean, maybe I'm overreacting, but in truth, what I've come away with in the last 15 years has been phenomenal, because all the people I've met, you know, academics, museum, alternative spaces, artists, you know, every archivist, the archivists are my idols. They, like, I wouldn't be able to do anything without archivists, you know, has been great. And I also made really good friends at MoMA that I'm still close to. I wrote an article with two of them after I left. And I've also, you know, invited them to speak to my students. So it's, I am very, very happy with kind of how the whole process and how I got here.
So in other words, I was mischaracterizing your experience of the community, that those denials or, you know, rejections were a minority to a generally solid community. Is that fair?
Yeah. And it was just funny to me, because at the beginning, I guess, because, you know, then I was like, you know, a very junior professor. It wasn't clear whether I was ever going to have, because at first I was a fellow, then I got a tenure track position, then I got tenure. So at the beginning, I was really kind of insecure. Like, I was going from being really insecure to being a little bit less so, but still insecure. Yeah, I just felt like there is a prestige to working in that museum, even if you're in a really like low level job and you're not, you know, it's still MoMA. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. Where would you say your insecurities are now, if any?
Well, it's taken me too long to finish my second, well, actually, I guess you would say my third book. It's taken me too long, but now I feel like I'm on track. But between my first book and this, I kept getting asked to like write for exhibition catalogs, or I had ideas and I had a place to publish an article. And so, you know, I published a lot of things, but I have to finish the book. This is typical of academics. Then, you know, the students turn papers in late, and we're just like, what's going on? Why did you turn the paper in late? And then meanwhile, the editorial assistant at Rutledge is like emailing, what's your timeline for this?
Oh, okay. Right. So in other words, you're getting behind on your delivery of your manuscript because of these freelance essays that you're writing.
And frankly, it's okay in the sense that I've published a very sort of a short version of some of my research, and then another article that talks about some of the material in another chapter. But, you know, it's also changed so much, and now it's so timely. Now it's so timely to talk about, you know, the inclusion of Latin American artists, and people are doing parallel work on African American artists. MoMA itself has published a really great book about the African American aspect called Among Others. And there's so much discussion about, you know, Latinx art and politics of diversity and inclusion or lack thereof. So my book is, you know, it's even more timely now. So this is how I console myself.
And where is it at in the evolution?
I've written, I have one chapter that's partly written that I had to finish, which is about the Cold War era and MoMA and Latin American art. And then I have the epilogue, which I started writing, which is actually about what we were discussing in regards to the 2004 install, and I actually start it by describing my reaction to what I saw, not going into so much detail about, you know, weeping and like, no, I wasn't weeping. I'm joking, but you know, that I was like getting teary. And then I talked to John, like that's not in there. That's just between you and me.
Oh, okay. Between you and me and whoever happens to listen to this. Got it. That's good to know. Thank you for sharing. I'm interested in, well, first of all, one of the questions that you just came up as you were talking about that is, do you enjoy writing? To what extent is it just something you have to do versus something that you enjoy doing? You know, does it run the gamut as, you know, depending on what it is and where you are in the process?
Yes. I honestly, my absolute favorite thing is doing research.
Right.
But then of course I have to, you know, do something with it. You know, there's one chapter in the book that I really enjoyed writing, because it was about a curator that was at the museum and did a lot of work relating to Latin American art and Caribbean art including looking at Puerto Rico, which is unprecedented. In the 60s, and her trace had been lost because she resigned from the museum. And so I was able to, well, one of her good friends was Lucy Lepard. And Lucy said, thank you for, you know, bringing her back to life or something like that. Thank you for resurrecting her. And it was a real joy to bring out this, you know, a woman curator and a woman that did a lot of things that are unprecedented and that are being done now. Mm-hmm. But she was blocked from doing some of the things that she wanted to do. And I was able to find her family. And, you know, it was incredible.
What's the
I felt really strongly about it.
What's the curator's name?
Elaine L. Johnson was her name. Mm-hmm. And she was a specialist in prints. And she worked in the Department of Prints and Drawings and also with painting and sculpture.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned how the art historians that you have known and have known have other pursuits, you know, and as artists of one kind or another. And that's you as well, because you have been making art yourself for some time, right?
Yes, absolutely. Since I was a little girl.
Oh, okay. Actually. So it's been all along. So at what point was there a turning point where you turned away from the path to being an artist to, you know, getting into curating?
Yeah, I really wanted to be an artist. I wanted to go to art school, but my parents said, you know, we don't have an income to support you. If you don't get a job, you need to study something that's practical. You need to study something, you know. So I thought, all right, I'll study political science and I'll be a lawyer or a diplomat. This is because I like to travel.
Mm-hmm.
I was really upset, but I tried taking some studio classes, and there was this drawing class that I took, and the teacher told me that I had no talent, which I think is malpractice.
Yeah.
And I would never say that to a student.
Yeah.
But, you know, I was just whatever. I was dabbling and I was writing poetry, and just, you know, I had a group of friends that were very, we had a little like literary and art magazine. And so we were just kind of going behind the backs of the art teachers. So I gave up on it until 6 years ago.
Mm.
And I started drawing again.
Mm-hmm.
At the insistence of my mother and my sister.
Oh, well, that's ironic. So your mother, who was at least part of the team that said you had to get into something practical, eventually kind of came around. And now that you had a job, I guess, right?
Exactly. Yeah. She knew I had tenure
because
I had just gotten tenure in 2013.
Right.
And also I had some really difficult things happen to me. And so they thought that this would be something that would, you know, sort of lift my spirits, I guess. And it's true. You know, so I just started drawing and drawing and drawing, and I went home and my mother had kept photo albums with my drawings in there.
Mm-hmm.
And that was hilarious to see what I was drawing.
Yeah. Do you mind my asking what the difficult things were, or do you prefer to keep those private?
Oh, no. I mean, it was just, you know, some... For example, I lost two very close relatives in 6 months, within 6 months of
mm-hmm.
each other.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that was one.
Right.
That was
right.
That was pretty rough.
Yeah.
you know, and I was showing up for them. Even they were in Spain, but I had my sabbatical, so I was in Spain too. Mm-hmm. 'Cause my father was born in Spain and my mother was born in Puerto Rico. Mm. So, that was pretty debilitating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. But my drawings are very entertaining. So that was a good move on their part.
When you say entertaining, do you mean they entertain you? And then they entertain whoever sees them as well? Is that how you mean that?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, for example, in the photo albums, I had, you know, like I was drawing John Lennon and Yoko Ono, you know, that famous picture from Rolling Stone. I guess I think it was Annie Leibovitz.
Mm-hmm.
I drew celebrities.
Mm-hmm.
And like, for example, I drew Princess Stephanie of Monaco, who I thought was like really hot.
Mm-hmm.
And she was in this Spanish celebrity magazine that has an English edition called Hello. And so she was in Hola, and I drew the picture, and I had my mom mail it to the palace in Monaco. And I photocopied this. Like, you can already see the way my mind works as an art historian. Like, mm-hmm. I was photocopying this.
Right.
And so I photocopied the drawing. I photocopied, you know, like the letter that I got back from the secretary of her Serene Highness, you know, thanking me for the beautiful drawing. So. Mm-hmm. That was kind of my, you know, that was my high point.
Yeah.
This was in high school.
That's awesome. Well, I know.
It was pretty funny.
You actually, even though you yourself, as a reaction to your parents saying that you needed to get a job, you know, or have a reliable income, you didn't study political science, or did you?
I did. I studied political science, and I took some art history classes,
mm-hmm.
and it actually came in really handy because later when I went to grad school, my dissertation was about visual propaganda exhibitions in the Spanish Civil War, looking at the two sides, the fascists and the Republican, you know, left-wing coalition.
Right.
And that was my first book. So the fact that I had a real understanding of politics in the early 20th century, and then I could bring in the art and the propaganda part, worked out really well.
But still, you got into a field eventually, art history, that is not necessarily known as the most reliable source of stable income, right? So, I mean, ultimately, you did get to go in your own direction despite the wishes of your parents.
Absolutely. And I am a very persistent person when I want something.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll try every possible way, you know, that's legal and healthy.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and then if it's impossible, then I give up. But it did end up working out well for me because, yeah, I was in a museum. I was, you know, working with artists and like people that I admire and look up to, you know, and others, you know, scholars that I look up to, and it's a joy.
How hard was it getting into not necessarily just MoMA itself, but, you know, into curatorial jobs? I mean, now it's, you know, it's hard to imagine how competitive it is. But I mean, back then, I presume it was a little bit easier. But I mean, did you have to go through a series of rejections from, you know, certain places before you could find a place where you could finally land a job?
It was really hard, but sometimes, you know, you're in the right place at the right time. And then sometimes also if you go to a certain school,
mm-hmm.
and you're the director of your thesis or one of your mentors has worked at that museum or knows or studied with a person at that museum, you know, there's like all of these connections, which is a problem, you know, when we talk about diversifying the field, because not everybody can afford to. I mean, I had scholarships too. And loans and everything, but you know, not everybody can afford to go to the Institute of Fine Arts, NYU or Yale or what have you. So, and then in my case too, because they had hired Paolo and were doing this, you know, these projects to really kind of bring back their work with Latin American artists, they needed somebody who had studied that mm-hmm. to be his curatorial assistant.
Right.
So it was just kind of like right place at the right time, because I had gone on an informational interview with the department manager, who's fabulous. And she was just like, okay, well, I'll keep you in mind and, you know, whatever. And then when this kind of fell into place, they called me back.
Right. So certainly your specialty or your expertise really did make a big difference, because if you had been studying post-war American art, right, that would have been a different route for sure.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, there were incredible people that I was working with there. Well, almost all of them were women, the curatorial assistants. But, you know, they would have this high level of expertise and were doing doctorates, you know, and with German art of the 1940s or something. And they would be working on an exhibition specifically related to that, you know. So they were getting like really, really, really well-educated people. And, you know, it's very competitive.
Mm-hmm. I don't know to what extent this is something that's you're familiar with, but I would imagine at least a little bit because of the industry that you're in. But what do you think about like your Sotheby's, you know, curatorial programs and whatnot, which are sort of sold or known as these, I don't know if finishing school is the right word, but sort of these professionalizing programs that are a path for young curators, you know, to get, I guess, into professional curatorial roles. I imagine they're pretty expensive to, if not very expensive to take, but are those numbers just too overwhelming to have room for everybody who goes through those programs? And so therefore it's going to be, you know, just a couple of people out of every class maybe that get jobs. What's your take on all that?
I mean, I wouldn't really know. I do know that some of my students do go on to those programs because they're more interested in the art market side of the equation. But it's hard to sort of track where everybody lands,
mm-hmm.
You know, but my sense is that those programs are to train you to be on the market end of things and not a museum, you know,
right.
curator.
Right, right. Okay. Yeah. And there's probably more room, I would imagine. Yeah, there's got to be more room in the market, you know, whether it's working at a commercial gallery or even, you know, some kind of advisory or tracked situation, or maybe even as a consultant, whatever.
Yeah, exactly. That would be like the range of, that's sort of the range of what some of my former students have done.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about Spain. As you mentioned, your mother is Puerto Rican, your father is Spanish, and you spent a lot of time in Spain. Was it initially, as you know, one would expect, because you know you have relatives there, and then you gravitated towards the country, and that's why you've continued going there over the years? What are some of the reasons that it's become kind of a regular place for you?
Oh, I you know, I haven't thought of that question before. I love, you know, the art. I love when we would go to the Prado. I have a memory of being a really small girl because we lived there when I was a very young girl for a year, and going to see the black paintings by Goya and being terrified, like wanting to run out screaming. I vividly remember this. Uh-huh. They've reinstalled it, so now it's very antiseptic, but it was quite dramatic. I'm talking about like 1972,
uh-huh,
something like that.
Uh-huh.
But I just, you know, I love the food, I love the culture, I love the music, I love the architecture.
Mm-hmm.
I was able to spend my junior year abroad there,
mm-hmm.
and take a lot of art history classes. And then I also spent 3 years there because I had a lot of different grants, including a Fulbright, to do my dissertation research, and I just kept dragging it out as long as I could.
Mm.
And I went to Barcelona and I learned to speak Catalan, and I just fell in love with Barcelona. It's just, there's nothing I love more than that city.
Mm-hmm. Talk about why. What was,
you know, I started going there in the mid-90s, and it was, you know, it was after the Olympics. It wasn't as like touristy as it is now. It wasn't as
right.
So it was still kind of felt more like authentic.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I have friends from New York who have now moved back home. But thanks to them, I was going there and I felt like an insider because I met their friends.
Mm-hmm.
And so I became part of this network of people. And a lot of them are, you know, artistic. They work in museums, etc. So when I go there now, I just like, I have a whole community of people. And because I speak Catalan fluently, that also opens up some doors. And then again, because of my research and my scholarship and collaborating with museums, giving lectures, et cetera, I just, you know, I know a lot of people there now. So mm-hmm. it's a lot of fun. And every summer I spend a month and a half in Barcelona, but I also go to Madrid because I have a lot of very close friends and colleagues there as well.
Mm-hmm. How was it hard to learn Catalan?
No, because my grandparents spoke Valencian, and Valencian is similar to Catalan. Like, it has a sort of intersecting, I don't know what you would call it, like roots.
Mm-hmm.
And it's related to Catalan. And then there's also what they speak in the Balearic Islands is also a related language. And so it was funny when I started learning it, because all the words were familiar to me.
Yeah.
Because, you know, when you start learning a language, it's things like a window, you know, finestra, a chair, cadira. And it was like chicken, puyastra. And it was like hearing my grandmother. Because the languages are very similar.
Yeah. What has your experience of art been in Spain, whether Barcelona or Madrid or both? Generally, as far as artists, as far as contemporary art, you know, what are some comparisons that you've noticed between Spain and the U.S., for example?
Wow, that's a hard question to answer, because I feel like my knowledge of the sort of different networks is limited in all of the places.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one thing that that I notice in Spain is that, you know, even if they don't have a lot of resources, they still organize things. They still set things up. They're still like trying to, you know, hustle and like help each other out. And that's something that I really admire. And in academia too.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, with academia, there's a horrific bureaucracy,
mm.
really, really awful. And there's one or two generations of doctoral students who may never get a job. And there, it's just very like top heavy. And then to get into a museum is also difficult, because many of the jobs, or most of the jobs, require a civil service exam.
Mm-hmm.
Then they open up, like the central government says, you know, well, we have, like a few years ago, it was like the biggest deal. They had 35 positions in museums of various kinds. And I have a very good friend and former student who, you know, was basically studying for time for like 2 years to pass the exam.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And then there were other like oral sections of the exams as well.
Right.
So it's really hard to get a job there in a museum.
One of the cliches that I remember hearing years ago about Spain more than any other European countries is that like people would have dinner at 10 o'clock.
That's right.
Yeah. So actually, when you're talking about your creator friends getting off at 8 or 8:30, they can wind down, have a couple of drinks, and then go have dinner.
I have to tell you, this is a good story. Okay, so I was asked by the MACBA, the Museum of Contemporary Art of Barcelona, to give like an artist talk conversation with this incredible artist. I'm sure many of the listeners know, Francesc Torres. And Francesc had this installation at the MACBA. So I went there, I went to Barcelona, and we were, you know, we had talked, we kind of primed what the conversation would be like.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a Barcelona football club game that night. And that's my team. And whenever I'm there, if I can go to the stadium, I do. So I was really freaking out, because I was like, damn, you know, I'm going to miss the game. But this is like my job. I can't like, and also because I'm friends with the woman who runs the programs who invited me. So I was like, I can't let Tonina down, you know. But then it turns out everybody was, they were like, oh, just chill, just relax. We're going to do this conversation, and then we're going to, so-and-so is going to drive us in the car to the stadium, and we have tickets for the game. And Francesc was all in, like everybody was all in. And so we ended up doing this talk at the museum and then going to watch the game.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And I was like, I love Spain.
Well, there's another cliche that you're breaking, which is being an academic and also, you know, let alone an art historian, also being into sports.
Yeah, that was random. It's just that I had some European friends in New York that were, and also South American that really liked the sport. And I watched, there was the year that Spain won the World Cup, which I think was 10 years ago.
Yeah, sounds
And
right.
that was a huge deal. And my dad is a big football club Barcelona fan. So I kind of like started to go in that direction. And then I found this local sports bar, which no longer exists, of course, like a lot of what's in New York. And anyway, I went there and I made all these friends. And so after that, it was like my social life expanded tremendously. And my dad and I had something to talk about. So it was a win-win.
Nice. Well, let's plug your book, even though it's not out yet. What is it going to be called, and when do you think it's going to realistically come out?
Let's see. I think it's called Museum Collection Displays and Canon Formation, Latin American Art at the Museum of Modern Art, which is essentially the story of this collection that started to be formed in the 30s and how different curators at the museum came to view it in relation to the rest of the collection and how it was displayed in the gallery. So just as we were talking about what's happening now or in 2004, that some of these works were actually exhibited, even though a lot of us thought that they were really in storage for a lot of the time. And so we can learn a lot from that now as museums are trying to become more quote unquote global, and kind of going to this case study of what was going on in the 40s and 50s and 60s at this museum, which is so influential and itself, as I said, it's has been working through its own history and trying to improve on things that they maybe didn't do before.
And so what's your ETA, do you think?
Oh my God. I have no idea. I mean, like I said, I have to write this half a chapter about the 1950s, and I have an editor who's helping me, and so I have to make the corrections that she suggested that I make. But I did have the other book that came out, the book about drawing, the book with the drawings. So at least that's that. Now I feel like I can say this is book three because another book came out.
What's the book with the drawings called?
It's called Retratos Hablados or Spoken Portrait. It's bilingual because there's an essay by me reflecting on the drawings and also sort of by autobiographical and scholarly, discussion of my feminist take on these celebrities and the sort of political and campy aspects of their the way that they present themselves and how they're depicted in, mass media.
Well, Miriam, it's been great talking to you. Thank you so much.
Same here. It's been a real pleasure. Really
Oh,
enjoyed it.
great. I'm glad to hear that. And we're out.